Welcome to EMS in Wisconsin, the official podcast of the Professional Ambulance Association of Wisconsin. Today we have a really fun interview for you. We're sitting down with Dr. Jarvis. He is an emergency room physician and a medical director for two services in Texas. He was recently in the area to present a few sessions at the Paramedic Systems of Wisconsin Conference. He's sitting down with us today to share a little bit about why he loves research, why it's important, and how we need to stop doing things just because we've always done them. Dr. Jarvis is up next. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jarvis. How are you?
I am doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And you are a medical director for two services in Texas, correct, as well as a paramedic, correct?
Yeah. So I'd like to say that I actually blatantly stole this from Dr. Jeff Beeson. We kind of went through medical school at the same time together, and he was a paramedic and a nurse before going to medical school. And I was just a paramedic before I went to medical school. I didn't do the nursing thing. I'd like to think I was smarter than him. And he says, well, really, I'm a paramedic who finally got a job that pays me what I'm worth. So I think of myself as a paramedic first and EMS medical director and physician second.
Nice. Well, we're happy to have you amongst us.
Well, thank you very much. It was great coming up to Green Bay last week, even if the weather was not exactly what I was expecting. It felt like Texas there. I was kind of hoping for some nice coldness. A break from the temperature, but the people were great, and it was awesome to be able to go out and go for a run and run around Lambeau Field. I've grown up looking and hearing about that field, so it's kind of nice to see it in person.
Yeah, that's always a treat for, you know, the out of towners to come in and see Lambeau, and if the opportunity to run around it is an extra perk.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. It was great.
So you were up here last week for the Paramedic Systems of Wisconsin Conference, where you did a few sessions.
I did one topic on basically performance measures. I have done some research on those and wanted to present the results of those. Those were basically the new performance measures coming out of NEMSQA, the National EMS Quality Alliance. That is the organization that is sort of picking up the ball from EMS Compass and continuing to move it down the field, if we want to stick with the football analogies. So I wanted to share some of the data that I had from that. And then the other two lectures were really extensions. They were literature-based lectures that came out of my podcast, the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, where we talk about EMS research. And we talked about some of the literature surrounding advanced airway management in cardiac arrest and the use of epinephrine in cardiac arrest.
And one of the things that caught my attention and why I wanted to have you on this podcast, there were a few remarks in your lectures that were interesting. One was the, why do we do things this way in EMS? Because we've always done them this way in EMS. And I feel like we're starting to break out of that mold a little bit, but still for some reason, EMS, public safety, and some might argue healthcare in general is really resistant to change, to doing things in a different way, even if it's been proven that the results are equally as good or better.
You are absolutely right. So, yeah, and it is so much so the case in medicine broadly. So it's not just EMS. It's not the fire service. It's just anything involving humans. This is a human attribute, not so much an EMS attribute or a fire service attribute or a medicine attribute. It's just because all of these things involve humans working together. And I agree with you completely. So it's interesting. I don't think I was the one who actually brought up this, we've always done it this way. I ask a question, and Dan is the one who brought it up, and I could not agree with him more. That's one of the things that I love to talk about. So in EMS, and absolutely in medicine, we are very, very, very literature resistant. There's this thing called knowledge translation, which is the movement of knowledge from clinical trials and converting that into clinical practice. And on average, from the time that something becomes accepted in the medical literature, it takes about 10 years for it to become accepted and practiced in clinical practice. So as an example of that, I'm not sure how long you've been a medic, but when I started as a medic, we thought we absolutely positively had to treat hypertension. If we didn't, people's heads were going to explode. They were going to get headaches because of the high blood pressure, and then their eyes would start bleeding and, you know, their brain would squirt out their nose. So we would give them nifedipine, Procardia. It was this little gel capsule, would poke it with a pin, squirt it under their tongue, and let it sit there. And it would absolutely lower their blood pressure. It was highly effective at lowering their blood pressure. So we just became absolutely obsessed that that was the right thing to do. Well, then we started seeing literature on what was happening to these patients when we were abruptly and emergently lowering their blood pressure. And it turns out they were having strokes. So when you looked at the two groups, those patients, everybody in these two groups had high blood pressure. One group, and they had the same symptoms. One group re-emergently lowered the blood pressure with nifedipine, and the other group we did not. And it turns out that the ones that we were emergently lowering their blood pressure had ischemic strokes more often. And it turns out our body, our physiology is pretty damn smart. Evolution works. And maybe there's a reason we were hypertensive. And maybe if it took us years and years and years to become hypertensive, it's not a problem we need to fix in 2.3 seconds. So we ended up causing harm. Well, so we knew that in the literature, and it still took 5 to 10 years before we really effectively got rid of Procardia in the field. And that's that knowledge translation or knowledge gap.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it takes so long to identify and then move to something else?
You know, it's a really good question. And there are probably a lot of reasons for it. It's, as with all psychology, it's complicated. And as with most psychology, I don't know the answer. I was a psychology major, which taught me enough to know that I don't know the answer. But I think there are lots of things that you can lump into this. So just getting ready for this pod, I had to do just a quick Google search. As my buddy Ritu Sani always says, I had to GTS it. Do you know what GTS stands for?
No.
By the way, I didn't either until I met him. It stands for Google that shit.
So nice.
I had to GTS it. And I came up with a couple of things. There was a webpage. It was just a brief blog post on the BMJ opinion site. And it was by a guy named Abrar Karan. And he titled it Things We Do for No Reason in the Hospital. And The classic example that he talked about is, for the love of all that is holy, why for stable patients on the med-surg floor are we taking their vital signs every 4 hours? Why do we leave them hooked up to a frickin' pulse ox, which we know perfectly well is going to beep for no particular reason other than just it wants to? Why do we send a phlebotomist in at 5 o'clock in the morning to poke them in the arm and get all this blood work that isn't going to change practice at all? Why do we do that? Well, we do it because we've always done it that way. And those are some of the examples that he pointed out as being a reason. So he had a couple of reasons. One was this thing called the default effect. And I just love this concept. And he describes the default effect as something a user, a clinician, he says a user or clinician will choose the default option unless the cost of switching to a different option is less than the cost of sticking with the default. So in other words, if you are going, and I think this is probably easiest when it comes to looking at physician behavior with electronic medical records. So a patient comes in to see me in the emergency department. I open up Epic because it's now at this point questionable about whether I can actually breathe without Epic. I certainly can't take care of patients without Epic. So if I want to order some things, I open up Epic and it gives me these order sheets that have all these orders pre-ordered. Well, it's really easy to just hit OK so that I can move on and see the next patient. It takes a lot more energy to unclick things that I know are not necessary. So that's the default effect. And I think that's incredibly powerful. So just for some EMS reasons, let's just say, how often do you see people putting saline locks into perfectly stable patients when they know there's nothing they're going to use that saline lock for? We do it all the time. I did it when I was a paramedic. We absolutely do it. And it turns out that the reason we do it is we're afraid we're going to get yelled at.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or it's just the default. It's what we do. It's what we've always done. But it's not terribly helpful. You know, if you've ever used Compazine to treat headaches, frequently people who get IV Compazine rapidly, Reglan to a lesser extent, or metoclopramide, are kind of the same way. If you give it really rapidly, people start to twitch. They get intensely uncomfortable. These, this dysphoria, and they just really dislike it. So they feel like they're kind of crawling out of their skin. Well, Benadryl is the treatment for it. So a lot of us, not liking to see patients that way, will just give Benadryl right up front. And it's just common practice now on a headache cocktail to use Benadryl. Well, the literature that's actually looked at this says it doesn't help. It doesn't help the headaches go away, and it doesn't decrease preemptively the dysthesias, these weird feelings. But why do we continue to do it? Well, because we've always done it that way. Sort of a cognitive inertia.
So taking this back to your system as a medical director, what do you do to kind of get around this or get through this with protocols, with treatment practices, with your paramedics and EMTs?
So I think it's a great, great question. So Texas is a little bit different than other states in that we are a delegated practice state, which means the protocols and the scope of care is whatever I say it is. So I could legally say that if you have a patient with right lower quadrant pain, I need you to give them antibiotics and perform an appendectomy. That would be legal. It would be stupid. We would all be sued out of our brains and we'd never practice again. But the law says that a physician in Texas has the unlimited, unrestricted ability to delegate his practice. That's not the way it is in most states. So one answer to this is I say you're going to do it this way just because I said. And I would absolutely have the legal authority to do that. And I would tell you that I would fail miserably. It wouldn't work. And that is just, it's a cultural thing. So there are a couple of things I do, but I started as an educator and still think I'm an educator. This is one of the things that I really like. If you look at where the term doctor came from, it came from the Greek word doctos, which means to teach. So once I learned this, it really made me happy because when I became a doctor, I just continue on my career as a teacher. So my default answer to any question, any problem, is that more education is the solution. So when I try to institute a new change, I do it with the mindset that I have to explain why I'm doing this and why I think it's important. As an example, we just switched from Philips MRX to a LifePak 15. So we changed. We have about 18 trucks on the road at any given time. Plus we have some squad cars and commanders. So we had to swap out 20 different monitors, and I didn't want multiple monitors in the field at one time. I think that was just a recipe for disaster. So we switched the entire system to it. And at the same time, we changed a process we do when we intubate. So we used to document things on our EPCR as ESO. They would just click boxes on ESO, more or less at the time that we did a procedure. Well, we're switching to a process where I want them to hit ketamine given, rocuronium given, intubation start, intubation end, and that's a mandated process. So I wanted people to understand why I was doing it, because it kind of seems like it's just a pain in the butt. It's more work to do. And most of us, our response to that is going to be forget it. We're just not going to do it. Or we're going to find a reason why we couldn't do it. But what I tried to do, and I just sent an email out today describing this, said, listen, here's the reason that I want this data. One of the things that we judge ourselves on is our first pass intubation success without hypotension or hypoxia. Well, some of your intubations, as we're looking at them, appear that you had these periods of hypoxia and hypotension during the intubation. Now, you're telling us you didn't, but I'm looking at the data and it says you are. but it turns out that the times were off. You had already resolved the hypoxia by the time that you intubated, but because the times were off and we don't have accurate times, it looks as though there was hypoxia. So if you do this, we're going to get better times and we're going to have a better representation of the great job you're doing. So that's just one example. When we switched from RSI to DSI, we knew that there was going to be a fair amount of resistance to it. And the biggest reason is we've always done RSI rapidly. So if we're going to intubate, it must be a life-threatening situation. And if we don't get the tube in, how long do you have to intubate? It's 30 seconds, right?
30. Okay. I wasn't sure if you were asking me or not.
Yeah. We have 30 seconds. Everybody knows that. Well, why do we have 30 seconds? Well, because we've always had 30 seconds. That's what was on a skill sheet somewhere. And it turns out that we don't turn into a pumpkin if we don't get the intubation before midnight. It doesn't matter. What matters is what is physiologically going on with the patient. So it took me, I knew this was going to be a big sell. So what I did was proved my point that we were hurting people by doing things rapidly, by showing them data. And I would show graphs of how low these saturations were getting. I would show them example after example of where we took a patient who needed to be intubated. We allowed them to get profoundly hypoxic, and they would get really, really bradycardic, and they would go into cardiac arrest. So I showed them the harm we were doing, and they were all on board. So I think it's important to explain why we're doing what we're doing. And I think that has gone a long way.
And you won't get any argument from me on the value of education, the conversations, the two-way conversations, explaining why that is a challenge for some. And one other thing that you said during your talks in Green Bay was you were going over a paper that your friend and colleague had written. Mm-hmm. And you had given the disclaimer that you were good friends, you were close, you've written papers together, and this particular one you were going to tear up in multiple ways from multiple angles.
That might have been a nice way of saying what I said.
And which, again, got my attention because, and I'm trying to think of exactly how to phrase this, but that attitude, that spirit of we can agree to disagree, let's dig into this, let me ask you a question, allow you to explain yourself so I can better understand and then present my perspective, a real, true, two-way conversation is great when you're on that level, when you're talking to a friend, right? Mm-hmm. But when you take that into an organization and you're on a medical director, medic, administrator, medic, supervisor, medic, on kind of two different planes. How do you, in your service, foster that kind of energy and interest and engagement in what you're doing and why you're doing what you're doing without feeling like somebody questioning you is a challenge to your position or authority?
So I think that is a wonderful question. And unfortunately, I don't really have a good answer for how to do it when you're a medic talking to your system administrator or your medical director, and they are dug in and are just not going to listen to what you have to say. I don't have a good answer for that. The answer that I did when I was a paramedic was I would leave. And I recognize I was able to do that because I was 21 years old. I wasn't married, didn't have kids, and I could just get up and move. That would not be an option for me now. I will tell you what I do as a medical director to make sure that I do everything I can to not put a paramedic I work with in that position. And it really kind of goes to, we have adopted this culture. It's called a just culture, and I'm sure y'all have talked about it a lot. Mm-hmm. When I look at things like mistakes or why we're doing what we're doing, I don't look at it as an absolute, you will do what I say you're going to do, otherwise I'm going to shoot you. Now, there are some times when I have to do that, but I've exhausted every other possibility. And I guess basically the bottom line is, as a medical director, I try not to be a dick. And I think that goes a really, really long way. I think there are leaders who who react very poorly to being questioned. Now, all of us may get defensive when we're questioned. I think that's a natural reaction, but most of us, our mamas raised us to the point where we realize that we should not be a jerk about it. And we should take a step back and actually think about it. Some people didn't. And I think when I see people who, when I question someone and I try to do it in a nice fashion and they get extraordinarily defensive and get very aggressive, the first thing I think about is, my God, how insecure can you possibly be? So I think that shows an insecurity. But my approach is to say, listen, I want you to question me because I promise you on this, I've been a paramedic 31 years. I've been wrong way more than you have. I have screwed things up more than you have. And it's not because I was a bad paramedic. It's just because I was a human paramedic and we all make mistakes. The best thing that we can hope for is to learn from those. And just because I became a physician doesn't mean that I'm going to stop making mistakes. I still need somebody to tell me when I've screwed something up. So any change that I do, absolutely, maybe it's right, maybe it's not. Ask me why I'm doing it. And maybe I'm wrong.
I want to talk a little bit about research in EMS.
Goody.
A favorite topic of yours, I imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm actually kind of amazed. I've been a good boy. We made it 22 minutes and 50 seconds into this podcast without me trying to convert it over to research. So I was sitting on my hands trying to be a good boy.
Well, I mean, we'll let you sit not on your hands for a little bit and kind of dive into it. Research in EMS, it's always been of interest to me, but I am in the geek category. So why do you think it's important, so important to engage more of the EMS community in research, and where is a good place for them to start?
Oh, this is one of my favorite questions. So why do I think research is important? Well, I think if you were to ask people why they got into EMS, most of us will say because we wanted to help people. We wanted to ease suffering. We wanted to save lives. I don't think many of us will say, well, we got into it because you know what? I hate people and I want to hurt them. And I'm going to get bonus points if I kill somebody by what I do. I don't think those people exist. That's not who we are. So when we get into something, we want intrinsically to do the right thing and help people. So if that's the case, and let's just say that we want to improve survival in cardiac arrest, well, what's the right thing to do? Now, the sad thing is the majority of it, we don't know. But there are some things that we're finding out, as we were talking about earlier, epinephrine and cardiac arrest. Well, if we think epinephrine is the right thing to do, and we've been doing it for a really long time, and now we have some solid evidence that maybe it's not the right thing to do, we have to fundamentally go back and say, what is our objective here? It is to help people. And if what we're doing is not helping people, then maybe we ought to do something else. So I think a classic example, and the only way that we learn what the right thing to do is through research. So I think that is why research is so incredibly important.
So how do we get more of the EMS community engaged and active in research and reading it and understanding it and participating with it?
So I think there are a couple of answers. The most important, and I hope everybody writes this down, is to listen to my podcast.
Now, shameless plug.
I know, completely shameless. As an educator, this kind of I used to run a paramedic degree program. I really think that this needs to be a core component of the paramedic curriculum. I think we need to have I would love to see it as a separate course, but at least it needs to be a component of our curriculum where we take a look at and read together some research papers. So our new hires in our academy, so as our paramedics are hired and come to work for us, one of the lectures that we give in that academy before they ever hit the streets is evaluating the evidence that guides our practice. And I give them a stack of papers. And the papers change at random, you know, from class to class, because it's not so much about what's in those papers. But we will take a paper based on whatever somebody wants to talk about, and we'll go through that paper. And what I want people to understand is that looking at a scientific paper if you don't understand what you're looking at, it's incredibly intimidating. And you think, oh my God, there are numbers and statistics and what's a chi-square and a p-value. I'll never understand that. And so we are intimidated by it and just close it off completely. And what I want people to understand is if you read these papers, it turns out that it's a lot easier to understand than you think it is. And I want people to understand that these papers are, there's a formula to writing these papers. Every one of these papers is written the same way in the same sections. The section that gives people most chest pain is the methods section. And from a science standpoint, that method section is incredibly important, but the statistics in it really are secondary. So overall, when we look at these papers, I want people to say, well, in general, just in normal people speak, what did they do? And why is this important? So we just reviewed a paper called the AVERT shock trial, where it was a trauma surgery study that was an in-hospital study, and they gave vasopressin randomly. It was a randomized controlled trial, so vasopressin versus placebo, and they gave it one or the other to these two groups of patients with penetrating thoracic trauma who were hypotensive and had already received 6 units of blood. Now, the big question is, does this decrease the amount of blood they need? Well, it does. And it turns out there were lots of statistics there. But the thing that is most important is you just look at it and say, well, what did they actually do? Well, they took this group of people who had gotten 6 units of blood and were hurt, and they broke them up into two equal groups. And they did one thing to one and another to the other group. And they just said, did one of these groups get less blood? Now, there are lots of statistics involved in that. And if you haven't taken lots of stats classes, or even if you have, most stats classes are taught really poorly, you just glaze over and don't try to understand it. But if you just look at fundamentally, we're comparing these two things, what happened? And just trust them on the stats initially and look at the results and say, well, does that apply to my practice? So I think that the fundamental check with the thing that is keeping people from looking at research, there are two things. Number one is we don't see the value in it because if our system has not, we're still doing the things we did in 1972, then clearly no one in that organization values literature. But instead, if you're in a system that does adapt to changes, then there's got to be something making those changes, something behind them, and that's the research. And if you want to understand it, you have to go to the research. So that's number one. Number two is get over the intimidation of the math. Just skip over the math initially until you really feel comfortable with it and just intuitively look at it and say, what did they do? And let's just trust them that the results are what they say they are. Does that matter to me? Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I think you're right. The intimidation value is a huge barrier for people to really read and dig into research or even discuss it because they might be able to read it. But if they don't feel like they have a good understanding of it, they're not going to be as willing to discuss it or bring a new idea forward or ask questions about why we're doing A instead of B.
Yeah.
So do you have any recommendations for resources where people, medics, administrators, whoever can go and start finding research, digging into research, learning a little bit more?
Yeah, so I do. Again, my shameless plug is my podcast. But
and what is the name of that podcast?
It's the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. We're part of the FlightBridge Ed family of podcasts. Beautiful. So you can go to Eric Bauer's website, FlightBridge Ed, and you'll see it there. You can look on Apple Podcasts. So that's one thing. The other is just look at the basic literature. So PEC, Pre-Hospital Emergency Care, that is the official journal of the National Association of EMS Physicians. And you'll see that's one place you can go for the peer-reviewed literature. Another place, there are a couple of websites that I think are really, really good. One is Rebel EM. It's REBELEM.com. And it is geared primarily to emergency medicine. But obviously, because EMS is a part of emergency medicine, the Venn diagram of overlaps is pretty large there. But he has this great way of taking a study and breaking it down into its constituent parts, making it really straightforward. And he'll put the entire summary of the study on a single slide. He's sort of that's my goal, is to be able to do that. I'm not quite there yet. He's way better at it than I am. But I think that's a very approachable website. So I would look at that. There are podcasts, not just mine. There are other podcasts that talk about research. I'm a big fan of The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Ken Milne does, he's a Canadian emergency physician, and he does a great job looking at the literature. So those are some of the places that I would start.
Are you a fan of the NAEMSP conference?
I am. I think it is. I was just talking about this today. I think that while I'm a huge fan of EMS World and EMS Today, and obviously the best EMS conference, which is the Texas EMS conference, I love NAEMSP. I think it's one of the highest yield conferences for me. And I don't really go to a whole lot of the lectures. I go to certainly some of them, and they're great. But the main thing I go for is the research. And when you go there, they have entire rooms set up that just have poster board after poster board after poster board with research abstracts. So I'll go through there and just look at these posters to get an idea of what people are doing. And then they will formally present the research, and they do that in one of two ways. The biggest is they'll have these poster abstract sessions, which are a lot of fun. There's usually an open bar somewhere around it, so people will grab their drinks, and they'll migrate in, and they'll get in groups. So this entire room will be broken up into about 10 groups, and each group will have posters on a similar topic. And so for NAEMSP, almost all of them are EMS. So one may be on airway management, another may be on sepsis. And you gather around, and the author, you just go poster to poster to poster, and the author of the paper will give a brief, say, 5 to 10 minute discussion of the paper, and then answer questions. So there's this just discussion that goes on. So that's the way all of the posters are covered. And then there's sort of a judging process where the papers that are the abstracts that are most interesting are selected for oral presentations. And there are probably 6 or 7 of these presentations where for the hour lecture, people come in for a lecture and they'll go through probably 6 to 10 oral presentations, where as the one of our posters got picked, we're talking about the therapeutic yield of red lights and sirens. So what we'll do is discuss the research in about 5 minutes, and then we'll answer questions for about 5 minutes and then move on to the next topic. Those are fascinating. And I think that is the research involved, the way you have to give the information to cover it in 5 minutes. It has to be approachable. So you can't spend a ton of time talking about the boring math. You just have to talk about broad concepts. What did we do? What did we find? And why is this important? So I think that's a pretty approachable thing. So I love the NAEMSP conference.
I've been there a few times over the years, and it's always on my list of, you know, when I set out my agenda for the year with traveling and conferences, it's always one that I look at. And I've recommended that to a lot of other medics, but it's the physicians conference. So I think a lot of people are afraid to go, but like you just described, I think there is so much value for just going and sitting and listening to all the research and what's going on out there, what people are looking at, what they're trying, and the results they're getting.
Absolutely. I mean, that really is, this is the first glimpse at the evidence that is going to change our practice. Great, great stuff. So probably 2 years ago, I was there, and a friend of mine, Vera Vitalani, who's the medical director for MedStar in Fort Worth, presented a paper that he and Dr. Richmond did where they looked at in their system, their primary approach to airway management and cardiac arrest was King LT. And it was mandatory that they would use end-tidal CO2. Well, the interesting thing is they compared, of all patients who got a King LT and had end-tidal CO2, they compared what the medic said was the success of the intubation to whether they had end-tidal CO2. And what they found is about 20%, and I don't remember what the exact number was, but it was somewhere around there, had unrecognized misplacement. So there was no air movement. And the medic didn't realize that. First off, I think that was pretty brave of Dr. Vitalani to actually lift up his skirt and say, hey, we got some bad stuff going on here. We're not perfect. We're making some mistakes. That is hard. So props to him for doing that. What came from that, when I saw that, I went, oh my God, a King LT is supposed to be foolproof, right? Any moron can do it, which is the way it's sold. And it's so much better than intubation because you don't have to interrupt compressions to put a King LT in like you do for intubation. Now, every time I hear that, I twitch because I know it's not true, but that's what people say. And I'm like, and what you're telling me here with some pretty good evidence is that it's not foolproof and we really need to pay attention to end-tidal CO2, even with supraglottic devices. So as a result, I went back and changed our practice. And we really instituted a hard stop. If you do not have end-tidal CO2, you pull the tube. I don't care what kind of tube it is, you pull it. You have to have end-tidal CO2. And where did I get that? I got it from listening to Veer's abstract. And I got that. He later published it in Resuscitation, but it was probably a year later. So we got that information. The first time I heard about it was from his abstract and got it right there at NAMSP.
Look at you shortening that translation gap.
That's right. That's right. You got to pay attention to these things. So interestingly, one of the other reasons that I think a lot of paramedics don't go to NAMSP, one, they may think because of the P in it, it's not for them, and that's not true. NAMSP has professional members. So professional members are non-physicians. So you can have membership in it. And by the way, if you're a member of NAMSP, you get pre-hospital emergency care for free. It just shows up in your mail. That's part of the membership. But the other thing is going to the conference is not the cheapest in the world, where EMS World and EMS Today may be a little bit more affordable. So if you go to those conferences, they also are now having abstract presentations and research forums. So there's a group called the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum, PCRF. Dave Page runs it. He's a PhD paramedic, and it's run through UCLA. So they do a couple of things. Every Monday, the first Monday of the month, they do a free webinar, which is basically a journal club. And you get to talk to the author of the paper, and they discuss it and interview them, and you can ask questions. So that's a wonderful thing. You can see it, just Google PCRF, Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum. So that's a great thing to read research. But PCRF is now hosting, and for the past couple of years they've done this, research fora, I think that's the plural of forum, at EMS World, and there are poster presentations in EMS World. There are poster presentations at EMS Today. So almost any conference you go to now, you're going to start seeing research. So when you see the poster up there, go read it. And if you see the author, ask them questions about it. They are dying. Trust me on this. They're dying to talk about it.
And it is so refreshing to see that to start coming to the EMS conferences over the last couple of years. And I just want to put out there too, for those that are interested in research or for those service directors that might be listening that have employees interested in research, keep an eye on it. Look up these websites and these groups and submit for the call for abstracts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So their PCRF, I mentioned that they do these things at these conferences. Well, they also host research fora. And they did one that I participated at in conjunction with ESO. So I, even though ESO doesn't pay me, I work with them a lot because they're in my backyard and that's who we use. So I use their data for research. They are very, very supportive of research. And one of the things they do is in conjunction with their user conference called WAVE, they offer a pre-hospital care research forum. And what happens with that is you come in and so it's a 2-day workshop. And there are some lectures about what research is, how you do it, what methodology is, what the steps involved are. And then you'll be assigned a mentor and a group. And when you do that, you have a data set. So the data set is obviously the ESO data. And they'll assign you to someone who can actually do the statistics for you. And you learn by doing. And at the end of the thing, you actually give a research presentation. And then the researchers will help you come up and, you know, write a paper. So they have one coming up. I want to say it's at the end of this month. So that's another plug. You see those.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Is there anything else you want to share?
You know, there is. And as I was doing some web searching, there are a couple of other things about why we've always done it this way is so important. And I just want to hit on a couple of them. One is a cultural deference to tradition and seniority. And I think most of us know that this is particularly profound in the fire service, where tradition is so, so important. And I went to Texas A&M, which we are huge believers in tradition, but sometimes that hinders us. So we kind of have this assumption that the old guys, the experienced hands, are the ones who are doing things, and they're doing things for a reason. They're the cultural leaders of the organization. And we kind of go along with it because we're new, and we just assume that there's a reason they're doing it. And we kind of doubt ourselves. So we just fall in line and do the same things that they're doing. And if we do bring it up, you know, we kind of mentioned they don't like being challenged, so they push back. And most of us don't really like conflict. I know there are some that do, and boy, do they stand out. But most of us don't like conflict. So we just go along with it. And before we know, you know, we're kind of the old hand and we're doing the same thing just because we've always done it. Another issue is the fear of the unknown. So ketamine is the classic example of this. When I go up to, so physicians who can do whatever the hell they want, they don't follow protocols. And I say, hey, you might want to consider, say, low dose dissociative ketamine for pain. They're like, I don't know, man. Bad things can happen from this. I hear that you start twitching and patients don't like it. I'm really afraid to do it. So there is that that ramp that you have to overcome, where they have to do a little bit of a leap of faith, where they have to trust the literature to do it the first time. And then once they've done it, they're like, wow, that kind of worked. The last thing that I can think of that I adopted, and I was a little nervous the first time I did it, was a treatment for headaches. It's a sphenopalatine junction block. And so the sphenopalatine is this nexus of nerves right up at the top of your nose. And those are sensory nerves, and they control sort of the front part of your face where a lot of headaches are. So there are a couple of ways to do this block. You can saturate a Q-tip with lidocaine and just shove it back there for 20 minutes, or you can just squirt lidocaine in their nose, like an intranasal lidocaine. And I'm like, geez, I don't know. I've never done this. This seems kind of odd. Maybe it's not going to work, and maybe patients are going to get upset with me. But I read these studies, and it looks like it works, so let's give it a try. And so there was that fear that I had to overcome, and sure enough, it worked reasonably well. There is another concept about fear of losing competence. So let's say I'll take something that I thought I used to, way back in the day, I was really, really good at spinal motion restriction. And man, I could do an amazing standing takedown. I was so good at this. And I got good because I practiced really hard. And now this is something I'm proud of. And I like being better than other people at things. I think most of us are a little competitive. And if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we'll say that we like that. And now all of a sudden you're coming along and saying, hey, the research says we shouldn't be doing that. Well, you're taking away the thing that I'm good at. And so I'm going to have a little resistance to doing that. There's always, and this I don't have an answer for, but this lack of trust in authority. This is the thing that gives us things like this anti-vax craze, where I don't believe vaccines are good solely because those people in authority say it's good for us. So I don't have an answer for that. I think it's a huge challenge. So those are kind of some of the things that I wanted to hit on when it comes to resistance to change. And then I think a lot of people have heard the phrase the quote that the most dangerous phrase in the English language is we've always done it this way. Have you heard that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So I tracked that down. I kind of like quotes. I tracked that down, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, but it was attributed to Admiral Grace Hopper. Do you know who she was?
No.
So she was one of the first female naval officers. She was a computer programmer. Well, she wasn't a computer programmer when she started because there were no such things. She was one of the first people to become computer programmers. She wrote one of the first compilers. A compiler is what takes more or less English language code and converts it into ones and zeros to binary and machine language. Sure. And it takes just an absolute genius to do that. She did that. You've probably heard about computer bugs, right?
Uh-huh.
She was the one who first named a glitch in a computer a bug. And it turns out, by the way, it's because a moth got stuck in the physical computer that she was using. And thereafter, she came up with that. And then the final thing, my favorite quote, and this quote really hit me and is one of the reasons that I decided to go to medical school. And damn it, if when I was looking this up today, I found out she didn't say it. But it is her, the quote that I love the most is a ship, and keep in mind, she was a naval officer. A ship in port is safe, but that's not what ships were made for. Sail out to sea and do new things. I just love that quote. So I think that sometimes we need to beware the comforts of an easy existence, things that we know and are comfortable with knowing. Sometimes we need to be open to evidence that says there are better ways to do things, because we don't grow if we don't do those. So I'm a huge fan of Admiral Hopper. So I just wanted to pass that on. So I do have a question for you.
Absolutely.
So tell me the name of your association again.
The Professional Ambulance Association of Wisconsin.
Now, how would you say that? Is there like an acronym for that? How would you say that?
PAW.
PAW. So what you're saying is this is the PAWcast.
It should be the podcast.
That is awesome. I think you should rename
it. We'll have to look at changing the name.
I think you should. That is so good. I think that's outstanding. Well, thank you for
your suggestion.
Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Well, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
That is so cool.
Yeah. I'll take that to the president directly.
I think you should. I think you should.